Council, ready to proceed?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Paul Bradley on behalf of the appellants in this matter. May it please the court. The court below decided that an assignment of a chosen action was proper, but then erroneously determined, with all due respect, that the assignment of claims between the appellants and Street Search Partners was chambertus and therefore unenforceable under Hall versus State, and denied the right of appellants to intervene or to substitute as a plaintiff in the case below.
Did your clients have intervened without the assignment?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe so. Because the basis of the motion to intervene was the assignment that they had given us.
Well, I understand that. But factually, could your clients have intervened without the assignment?
There was, potentially, there was a settlement agreement entered into by the parties, which isn't a part of this record, which provided that certain assets of Street Search Partners belonged to or could be pursued by the appellants in this case.
But that's tied to the assignment.
That the settlement agreement is separate from this assignment, but I think it also refers to the assignment.
Does your answer mean that there was no equitable claim or equitable remedy that your client could have sought, that it was solely a legal claim and that legal claim is grounded entirely in the assignment?
I believe the motion to intervene was clearly based on the assignment that we received.
I think Justice Ridgely's question in mind is, was there any other basis to avoid the chambertus suggestion in that there was some other right that could have been asserted in equity or an equitable remedy that might have been available or some other legal right outside of the assignment that could have been asserted?
Not that I'm aware of right now. The court decided that the assignment was chambertus on the basis that the court believed on the record it had that there was no relationship between the appellants and Street Search Partners, no relationship to the bond or the cause of action that was going forward, and we believe that was incorrect. The relationship between A&R Investments and Street Search dated back to at least 1999, based on the record in this case.
What was that relationship?
The A&R and the individual appellants had invested money with Street Search Advisors. Street Search Advisors was the management partnership for Street Search Partners. And Jeffrey Podesta was the general partner of these entities.
When you say invested money with them, you mean invested in them as an entity or invested money with them in the sense that placed money with them for them to manage?
The latter, Your Honor. And the in 2004 in New Jersey, as more background, the appellants sued Street Search Partners, Street Search Advisors, and Mr. Podesta for mismanagement of the investments that they had given or invested with Street Search Advisors. There are different counts in the complaint, including breach of fiduciary duty, breach of contract, and others. Out of that litigation arose a settlement agreement and the assignment that we're here concerning today. The assignment provided that A&R and the appellants would have all rights, title, and interest in the claims that were being pursued by Street Search Partners in the Delaware action.
But the appellants, A&R Investments, and the individuals were not direct investors in Street Search Partners. Is that correct?
That's correct. They were investors in Street Search Advisors, the management company for Street Search Partners.
Is there anything in the record that shows what the precise relationship was between street search managers and street search partners?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
I mean, is it just a contractual relationship, or do we not even know that?
There is nothing in this record to show that, Your Honor.
As far as we know, they're independent entities. That is, partners and advisors.
I think it was accepted below that they were related and managed by Mr. Podesta, and that Street Search advisors managed this fund, Street Search Partners.
But but
the record was not developed beyond the denial of the motion to intervene.
All right, so we know that they have some management function, but we don't know by what auspices, that is, whether it's by contract or because they own a controlling interest in the partnership, or whether they're a managing partner or what, correct?
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
All right, and the individuals are even one step further removed from Street Search Partners.
Well, the individuals also invested approximately $600,000 with Street Search Advisors. So they are in the same position as...
Was A&R Investment a separate entity? A&R Investment? Is that an entity?
That's a New Jersey partnership entity.
Okay, and then the individuals are the partners?
Yes. And right. Based on the record and the certification from Mr. Podesta, A&R and the individual appellants invested money in Street Search Advisors in 1999 and 2000. In light of the state of the record, there was no opportunity to have discovery or further information regarding these issues. As I said, the assignment arose out of the New Jersey action, which was resolved, and the Delaware action briefly involved Street Search Partners attempting to recover a debt owed to it by Rycon International and by EnviroBorg, the appellee in this case. The basis for that was Street Search Partners had loaned money to Rycon, $250,000, so that Rycon could enter into a bond with EnviroBorg, and EnviroBorg received the money that's the subject of this case. And in the underlying case, it's clear, I believe, based on the bond, which is a part of the record, that EnviroBorg was obligated to repay the money to Rycon in October 2001. Based on my knowledge, and I haven't heard differently, there no repayment was actually made of that $250,000, so that money is still outstanding.
The parties to the bond, the $250,000 bond, correct?
Pardon, Your Honor?
The bond was for $250,000?
Yes, Your Honor.
The parties to that bond were EnviroBorg and Rycon?
Correct.
Rycon? Not Street Search?
Correct.
Okay, so... what, I mean, although it may be the fact that Street Search loaned the money to Rycon, which then loaned the money to EnviroBorg, what legal or equitable interest did Street Search have in the bond to which it was not a formal party?
I think the court below decided that I believe that it had no interest as a third-party beneficiary. Clearly, the money was loaned to Rycon so that it could deal with EnviroBorg, and it was not a party to the bond. And the court below, in its prior decision in this Delaware case, determined that Street Search did not have any interest in the bond itself.
But had only a claim for unjust enrichment.
Yeah. Right. Rycon in the case below never appeared, never answered the complaint. And then in 2006, the motion to intervene was filed, the assignment was entered into, and the court ruled, as I said, that it was chamfered as based on Hall versus State. I believe I talked about the interest that we have. The The one part of Champerty under that case and other decisions is that the party coming in is a stranger to the parties to the lawsuit. In our opinion, that wasn't the case here because A&R and the appellants had a prior relationship and business relationship with Street Search Advisors, the management company for the Street Search entity that was a party to this case. And I think that the relationship dated back in this record back to 1999 when they loaned them money.
And should it matter whether or not the plaintiffs were strangers? That is, suppose, you know, we know now that Street Search had a claim for unjust enrichment against EnviroPort.
Yes.
Street Search could have assigned that claim, say at some discounted value, to anybody, could it not?
I believe so, yes, under Delaware law.
So why does it matter one way or the other what the relationship was of the plaintiffs to Street Search?
Well, in the way this case is currently set up, it only matters because the court below decided that while the assignment was valid and allowable under Delaware law, it was champertous because there was no relationship, existing relationship, between any of the entities, and the appellants were strangers to Street Search and EnviroPort. And so the fact that there was a business relationship becomes important if you accept the court below's decision.
Well, as I understand it, the court below found that the assignment was champertous for two reasons. One, that the assignees were strangers. Secondly, that there was an agreement to split the proceeds of the litigation.
Correct.
Right? But if there weren't any agreement to split the proceeds, just as a purely commercial matter, Street Search had simply assigned its unjust enrichment claim to some complete stranger who was willing to pay, you know, some discounted price, some discount from the value of that claim, that would not be champertous, would it? Assuming there were no side agreements to split the proceeds.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
So is it not the case, and I'm just asking you this, that the only issue here that matters is whether or not there was an agreement to split the fee or the proceeds of the litigation?
Well, if correct, certainly if there's no agreement to split the proceeds, which there wasn't, then it's not champertous on that basis either. And certainly that's our position. We had no agreement with Street Search, and I think the assignment that's in the record proves it, to split the proceeds with them. The court below found that in an agreement that any proceeds received from the Delaware case would reduce the Street Search's debt or liability to us constituted splitting the proceeds. But the court below and no one involved in the case has cited a case that has held that to be a splitting of the proceeds or a division of the proceeds that's required under Champerty law. And so in this matter, we don't have, at least in our position, we don't have strangers to each other. We don't have intermeddling or someone just coming in off the street and pursuing a claim, even though that could be allowed under Delaware law as far as the Delaware cases are concerned and that the court below found were valid. We don't have a division of the proceeds. And then the last part is, was there some agreement that A&R would pay the expenses? Well, we never even got to that far, but there's no evidence in this record about who is going to pay the expenses or who ultimately is responsible for the expenses in pursuing the case. So the court should have allowed some more time to have a record that was developed if it wanted to make this type of decision.
I understand that there were basically alternative grounds for invalidating the assignment. One was that it was champertous, and the other was that even if it wasn't champertous, there was no consideration given for the assignment. Is that right?
The court said that if the consideration for the assignment was not if the consideration for the assignment was not reducing the debt of Street Search, then there was no consideration,
right,
and therefore no valid assignment. But even on that basis, the court below did not have a record where it could make that decision. This issue came up on a routine motion to intervene or a routine hearing day on a motion,
right,
to intervene.
You're saying without having the settlement agreement or the agreement documenting the settlement of the New Jersey litigation, there was no way to determine what, if any, consideration was given for the assignment?
I think that's correct. And I think if the settlement agreement shows that even the expenses and fees are the obligation of or obligated to Street Search to reimburse in the end, or it increases their own debt. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Joseph Bodner, Monzac and Monaco, on behalf of the EnviroBoard Corporation. I had started a much different presentation, but having listened to the opening, I think I want to address two specific items relating to this case, and then address some of the broader considerations of what the law of champerty means to commercial relations generally and to our state. I heard some questions discussing in this specific case whether there was any interest on behalf of A&R or the assignees. And some of the questions that you asked from the bench, I think, seem to indicate that there really isn't any interest here. This might be a little bit harder case, perhaps, if the investors had actually invested money, perhaps the stockholders, or along that line, as opposed to what Mr. Bradley said was just an investment with, I think he said, was the way the investment was made. I think that when you're investing with someone, it's much different in its character than an investment as a stockholder in an entity. And so I think because of that, there really isn't any interest as the whole case would require. And it's even more removed because, as I understand the relationship between partners and advisors, is that advisors is one more step removed, as it were. So because of that, I think there's clearly no interest here. And if that were the only issue involved in this case, I think you could just apply the rationale in Hall and affirm the court below.
Mr. Bodner, I'm still stuck on this question. Maybe you can help me. Why there has to be an interest? That is, why couldn't Street Search, simply executed a commercial assignment of all of its claims, or its claim for unjust enrichment, to a stranger who was willing to pay, something, I guess, less than the value of the claim in order to have to step into its shoes and have the right to sue?
Well, that's a good question. I think that's right. I think had they done it that way, and I think our statutes provide a way for that to be done, I forget the statute off the top of my head, 2702 or something, it provides that if you have an assignment of a chosen action that's sealed and complies with the formalities of the law, that it's a valid assignment. And if that had happened here, if the assignment that was used in this case had been structured in that way, I think we wouldn't be facing this issue of whether or not this assignment is champerty.
Which brings up the issue of why that old common law doctrine has any meaning at all anymore, because it's no less chamfers to formalize an assignment to give somebody a right to sue someone else when they have no reason to sue that person other than to pay for the right to sue them. That's as offensive to the common law as pure chamferty. So one could argue that the statute that creates the shows and the assignment that you're talking about is an abrogation of the common law. But in the commercial world, why are we still dealing with chamferty at all? Why is it still an issue? Most of the Commonwealth countries, it isn't anymore.
Well, Your Honor, I guess if we were dealing with people who are on a level playing field and you had a situation where you had sophisticated buyers on one side and sophisticated sellers on the other side, then perhaps you would say that the rule of law should be essentially freedom of contract, and they should be able to do whatever they want to do subject to some overriding public policy. And if you were to go back into time and look at where chamferty sort of had its roots, there's a good case called Bluebird Partners. It's out of New York. It's from the Court of Appeals, a 2000 decision. It goes back to Chase.
Well, it's more likely that chamferty had its roots in York rather than New York. But
well, that may
I'll
be.
Accept that.
That may be. But in this case, they say that chamferty grew out of the medieval situation where land really was power. And it was concerned with people basically for a discount taking over certain fee positions so that they were entitled to profits of land. And by doing that would give themselves even more power and wealth than they already had. And at the same time, perhaps burden the courts with suits about who had the right to the profits, et cetera, so that eventually those, what they call in this case power plays, would be burdens on the state in terms of litigation and taking up judicial time and the like. So as I said before, I think if you had sophisticated people on both sides of a transaction, perhaps then we'd have a harder a question, and you might say, why shouldn't they be able to engage in a deal as long as it's not criminal or violate some other overriding public policy? I would agree with that.
Even if you have unsophisticated people, you have lawyers involved, or at least on superficially sophisticated.
Well, that leads to the other question. Basically, what we have here is we sort of have the universe of assignments that could be made. And the statute carves out basically a safe harbor and says if you comply with the formalities of the statute, it's a safe harbor, and you will not be subject to this defense of chamferty. And that takes care of probably 90% of these cases. They say bad facts make bad law. This might be one of those cases. But the fact is, this case sort of cuts right through and falls in the cracks of all those things. If they had had lawyers, which I think they did in this case, and if they had complied with the statute, we wouldn't be here today having this discussion about whether chamferty applies or whether the policies that chamferty grew out of still apply today.
Mr. Bodner, the statute that you refer to deals with assignment of bonds, specialties, or notes in writing. Doesn't say anything about choses in action.
It doesn't cover choses in action, Your Honor. I thought it did.
It doesn't. Not the section 2702 that I'm reading.
I have a minute to check my notes, Your Honor.
Well, since we're all looking, I'm going to turn your clock off for a minute.
Thank you. Well, Your Honor, I think when I had had that thought, I was looking at the decision in Hannigan from 1940. And in that section, they're citing, I think, the code from 1935, section 4649, which says that any action brought upon any other instrument in writing.
Well, I think the concern the Chief Justice expressed it better than I did is that the Champerty doctrine that the Superior Court appears to rely on seems to run headlong in conflict with ordinary commercial practice. That's one practical problem, big picture problem that I have at least.
I would agree with that, Your Honor, and I think that other states who have looked at this have approached it in somewhat a different way. One solution, I think, could be if you were permitted to assign chosen actions with a seal and a credible witness, like other notes and bonds, that would provide a safe harbor. I guess that's not something this court can do.
If that were true, that may be, but our statute simply doesn't deal with the subject. So unless there's some other statute that you can point to, we're still in the common law, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
And in the real world of commercial dealings, you know, if you're going to be assigning a chosen action, in a commercial transaction, it's almost always going to be with a stranger to the subject matter of the action.
It may well be, but as you said, with respect even to notes and bonds, there are certain formal requirements that are required in order to formalize, memorialize the process of that execution.
But those formal requirements, such as they may be, are not before us, and they weren't a concern of the superior of the trial court, were they? And basically, the trial court said there are two things that are wrong with this assignment. Number one, it was made to a stranger. And number two, there was an agreement to split the proceeds of the litigation.
That's right. And I think perhaps we're talking on two different levels.
All right.
My first point was, and I had started discussing this about the interest, and the other issue that I didn't get to was the splitting of proceeds, but I'll address that a little bit later. At that level, we're talking about just applying the rule in Hall, and if you don't change the rule in Hall and you apply it to this case, I think that the interest issue is not really an issue, and that, in fact, there was no interest in the litigation. They're not claiming that they had an interest in the bond, so it would have to be with respect to the litigation, and there isn't any. So on that ground,
they're claiming they had an interest in the Asinor.
Right, through the various levels that we had discussed, which I explained. I think that just puts you so far out there that you're no longer truly interested.
Assuming that there must be an interest.
Right.
I think I may have oversimplified it in my own mind, which I have a tendency to do, I candidly admit. But if X owes Y a debt and Z owes Y a debt, and X and Z can settle that debt that they have with each other by assigning what Z may owe Y to X, how does that foster false litigation? Why is that? Does that just make perfect sense? It ends one litigation with a settlement and an assignment, and it spurs the other litigation that already exists to conclude. It doesn't, as Champerty tries to avoid, stimulate new, totally unrelated litigation. So why is this Champertus, even in the old common law sense?
Your Honor, I don't think I can disagree with you, so I'm not going to stand here and try to make up some great-sounding reason why I think it is, because as I stand here, I agree with you. And my point earlier was that if we apply the rule in Hall to this case, I think you should affirm below. But if your question is what happens on this set of facts if we change the law with respect to Champerty, how does it then get applied to this case, my answer would be, well, then maybe it changes the result.
Well, my real question to you is, does a change make sense given commercial practice of today and the non-viability of the practice that Champerty tried to prevent in the past as it relates to today's world? Champerty was to prevent unnecessary, expensive litigation, as I think you articulated. As it applies to this case, there's litigation ongoing anyway, and this helps end it, not foment it and foster it.
Well, let me address that on two levels. First, let's address it with respect to if you were to change the rule, how would you change it? I think I had said earlier that I thought that if you had basically two people buying and selling a show in action who are sophisticated, understand the rules, have equal bargaining power, I think that in that realm, I think freedom of contract should apply. And unless the original contract said you can't assign this without the consent of the other party, I think that that contract should be freely assignable.
Are you suggesting that that would not be allowed under the common law?
Well, I think you would still need to fit into the rule of Hall, which says you need to have an interest, and if you're in the situation that we're in today.
Right, the rule of Hall, are you suggesting that Hall is inconsistent with common law or not?
I think that it is a little bit different in the sense that it's specific, in the sense that it absolutely requires an interest.
All right.
So that is, there is no interest.
Authority, if Hall didn't exist and we were writing on a clean slate, what authority should we look to?
Well,
for the common law.
I guess that's where we would be. We would be back in the common law, and we would look to England, the English law, I think, for the answer to that.
Well, what is, do you know the answer?
I don't know the answer to that as I stand here today.
Mr. Binder, I'd like you to address the other two issues, or I guess they're grounds that the lower court relied on in reaching its result. One of them was that, totally apart from the interest issue, that this assignment was champered also because it provided for a splitting of the proceeds of the litigation.
Right.
That's number one. Number two, wholly apart from Champerty, the assignment was not valid because there was no consideration. The problems that at least I perceive with both of those rulings are, number one, that there was no agreement to split the proceeds of any litigation brought by the S&E. That is, the S&E could keep 100% of whatever proceeds it had recovered.
That's right, Your Honor.
And secondly, to the extent that the lower court was concerned that there was no consideration given for the assignment, there was nothing in the record to support that. What is your response to those two answers?
Well, let me ask you about the second one first. What do you mean nothing in the record to support it?
The argument in favor of consideration was that to the extent, well, that to the extent there was a recovery that in the litigation, the recovery would be credited against whatever debt was owed. I suppose by street search, if I have that right, to A&R.
Understood.
Okay. The response was, yeah, but there is nothing in the record that supports that that theory.
Well, let's work backwards since we're already talking about consideration. If there's nothing in the record with respect to the consideration for that, I think the fault for the state of the record rests on A&R, and that if there isn't any evidence to support the consideration, then the consequences that flow from that fall on them. I don't think that really
is. Your side wants there to be consideration, doesn't it?
Well,
or not.
I guess if there's consideration, then that's not a reason to affirm below. It doesn't mean that you still can't affirm the decision below on the other grounds that were in that opinion. It would just mean that.
Well, let me just ask you this. Was that my statement of the theory of consideration a correct statement?
I think that it is,
okay.
Your Honor.
Secondly, is there any document or other evidence in the record to support that statement?
I don't believe there is.
All right.
Unless it's recited in the assignment itself, and I can't tell you if it's recited in there or not. I don't believe it is.
All right. Now, turn to the splitting of the proceeds issue.
Yes, Your Honor. I think with respect to the splitting issue, I think what the judge below was trying to say, essentially, was that the split is implied. And by saying that, I think the only time you cannot have splitting is if the buyer agrees that all of the fruits of that litigation would be turned back over to the seller. So even in this situation where it's 100%.
I'm sorry, you're saying.
Well, it's
even though
it's
in
as
reality,
if we were kids
even
again.
Though in reality there's no splitting, that there's some sort of constructive splitting going on here?
Well, yes, basically a fiction, an implication that's drawn from it. It's as if, you know, we're doling out the candy, and I say one for you and two for me. Only in this case, instead of giving you the one, I say zero for you, three pieces of candy for me. And so that's a split, although one person gets zero.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Briefly, Your Honors, I think if one side got zero and the other side got the three, that means there was no division or split. They're getting nothing, and therefore there is no split of proceeds and there's no violation of the Champerty document as the court or doctrine as the court below discussed.
Are you saying that Hall is the correct statement of the law or an incorrect statement?
I think the facts in Hall led the court to apply a very old doctrine. And at the end of the opinion, the court said, reminded everybody, we don't want to interfere with the commercial world out there. And in Hall, the court was faced with two people who had no relationship other than they ended up in prison together. And one took an assignment from the other to try and get back forfeited property from the state of Delaware. So they were true strangers, had absolutely nothing to do with each other, and the court looked at that and hearkened back to the Champerty doctrine. But at the end of the opinion, it said, basically, let this have no effect on the commercial world, if you read the last couple paragraphs. So while it may have recited proper law and things of that nature, the circumstances were completely different in terms of its application.
But there is a statement in Hall that an agreement is tainted with Champerty where the assignee had no interest in the cause of action prior to the assignment. Is that an accurate statement of the common law?
I believe so, and I think in Hall, it also goes on to say that that the doctrines apply only to volunteers or strangers, those who have no legal interest, those who have no relation to either of the parties, and those who are not acting as lawyers. And in this case, I don't think these parties are strangers, and I think the assignment itself proves that they're not strangers. In terms of the consideration, the assignment refers to the settlement agreement, which then...
Well, they may have not have been strangers, but they weren't exactly friends.
No, they were not friends, that's for sure. They were at one point until mismanagement occurred and they sued each other. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.